Welcome back, everybody, to a new episode of The Art of Flying. Thank you for anyone who is subscribing and listening. I appreciate you. Whether it's a few of you, or hundreds, or thousands of you, depending on the episode, I'm grateful for each and every one of you listeners. So thank you for tuning into this and also following the other ventures I have going on and supporting. The story today that I'm going to dive into is about two things that should never be possible by what we're taught becoming possible. And they're real stories, true stories from my life. I've discussed all of these things with doctors. There's tons of medical documentation on what I'm about to share with you. So if anybody questions the credibility of this story, and you have the resources to contact all of the doctors involved, whose names I'm not going to be sharing for many obvious reasons. I may share a couple who did help me. But ultimately, none of the doctors in any of the situations I'm going to explain here had any understanding or, therefore, belief in what had happened. And the explanation it was given was sometimes things happen in medicine that we don't understand. And remember, these are people that we trust with ourselves, with our health, who are supposed to be educated, who are expected to be knowledgeable and understand what is in front of them. And I have rarely met a doctor who is competent. My childhood doctor, a guy by the name of Dr. Goyle, was one of the only competent human beings that practiced medicine I've ever met in my life. Now, the first part of the story starts when I was about 11 years old. I was in sixth grade. I remember this vividly because it was an awkward time. I just started middle school. So the town I went to school in, we had a school for grades kindergarten through fifth, which at some point changed to fourth and fifth grade. And a couple other schools took over for kindergarten through third. But I was in the same school, Ryerson, until fifth grade. Oh, I'm sorry, Hewitt until fifth grade. And then I moved on to Martin J. Ryerson Middle School from sixth to eighth grade. And in sixth grade, it was my first year in this school. So you're the kind of low guys on the totem pole in terms of age of the school. And it's a tough time. That's when we start puberty. That's when, you know, real social dynamics start forming and cliques and groups and bullying gets to the next level of like fist fights and hormones and dating and kissing a girl for the first time and more and just, you know, those awkward situations of everybody is feeling awkward, but everybody thinks everybody else is feeling confident. So there's this weird middle school play right before high school, and we get a little more mature and aware of social dynamics. It's a challenging time for kids. So I had the dual, let's say, attack of puberty and Tourette syndrome. And the combination of the two and the stress of being in this new school and this new environment and kind of feeling a power structure for the first time in my life and feeling that, yeah, quite simply, I was an athlete. And as a sixth grader, you're not able to play sports. Only the seventh and eighth graders are allowed to play sports for the school. So you feel this iniquity so it was just, I remember, I'm going to tell a few stories of some other people in the class, but I remember, you know, one guy, kids were wearing like sweatpants and shit back then. So, you know, like one guy got embarrassed in class because he had a boner in class and everybody was laughing and it became a thing. And another guy had kind of like uncontrollable bowel movements that were related to nerves. And he, without better explanation, shit himself in the middle of class one day. And it just, you know, these things would happen in elementary school, and it is what it is. Like, kids are kids, and accidents happen. But in middle school, everybody expects to be cool, and you can't do stuff like that. So it was like an unconsciously terrifying social atmosphere that, like, God, if you had, like, a booger on your face, that could ruin your reputation or something. Like, so trivial and stupid, but very important when you're a kid that age to, you know, continue to make the right impression. And I was sitting there with Tourette syndrome and hormones and stress would amplify the tics. So it was very apparent, and, you know, I'd started to develop strangely bullies for the first time in my life, and I would get picked on every day, and it just made no sense to me because I was a very intelligent kid. I was popular. I was the best athlete in the school and in the grade at that time, and it didn't make sense that I was getting bullied, and, you know, it was teaching me empathy for other people, and maybe I've bullied people in my life that I shouldn't have, and, you know, it put me into place, but at the same time, it didn't make any sense to me. So every day I would go home, and, you know, I didn't really have much of a social life because of all the sports I played, and I also lived quite isolated from other neighborhoods. Like, I lived in a town, Ringwood, where all the houses surrounded lakes, and most of the kids lived in these communities, so they could all just walk out of their house and go hang out with each other. And I lived up in the mountains of a place called Stonetown, so, you know, we had a few people around, but if they were out with their friends or something, there was literally nobody around. I was hanging out with animals more than I was humans most of the time. So I always would go to this beautiful kind of stone-faced mountaintop nearby, a little hike away from my house, and my parents would be at work until, you know, 6-7 o'clock at night, typically, and I would just have 3 or 4 hours on my own. So I would go to this mountain and be looking at nothing but beautiful rolling green mountains of trees, northern New Jersey, and it was in a perspective that you actually couldn't see any roads or houses or neighborhoods, and you couldn't hear any human activity, for the most part, going on. And I would just sit there, and, you know, at some points I would try to build a little hut out of, you know, broken branches and stuff, and I would build a little stone fort and make it my own. But most of the time I was just kind of sitting there and breathing and questioning life, God, the universe, why I was suffering through this Tourette syndrome that every doctor and every so-called expert was saying was incurable, and you could only medicate for it, and that would only, you know, limit the tics, and you'd still feel the impulses and the tension, and it's a part of you forever, and blah, 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 blah. It just seemed like nonsense to me, like people that didn't know what the hell they were talking about trying to help people that they didn't understand, and it was so silly, even for an 11-year-old to witness what was going on in society, that, like, it was all apathy and, like, pretend help, and nobody actually cared to do anything to help anybody. They just wanted to throw a blanket over the mess on the floor and forget it was there for a moment. And it was terrible. I didn't even have super bad Tourette syndrome, so I couldn't even imagine the plight the other people felt that were suffering through it and were given these limited or almost no options for resolution. So as I'm thinking about this and getting frustrated, I thought, well, if I want to get better at sports and I want to get, you know, stronger at something, I have to extend my skill, extend my ability to control that basketball or juggling a soccer ball or being able to run without getting out of breath longer distances at faster speeds. And it just seemed like, okay, so humans are built for this. I'm really good at this. Why can't I view Tourette syndrome as, you know, a hurdle or 11 players on another soccer team that I have to figure out how to navigate through to score a goal and win the game? And I started visualizing it like that and realized that the tics were correlated with my breath, which obviously is, you know, correlated to your heart rate, which is, you know, connected to stress level. So I thought, as I feel the ticks coming on, I'm just going to breathe and replace the need to commit to the tick, the impulse, with a breath. And every time that I would feel an impulse of a tick coming on, instead of giving into it, I would just breathe deeper and slower and focus 100% of my energy, mentally and physically, on my breath rather than what the Tourette's, the tick, was trying to tell me to do neurologically. As if it was like a misfiring, an electrical misfiring that I just needed to figure out how to get under control and insulate and then channel the right way. And, you know, I didn't know what the end result of that would be, but at the time it was working. And week after week, I would go back there, you know, a few days a week probably, and practice this. And what it allowed me to do was throughout the day, I would not commit to any ticks. I would feel the impulse, I would breathe it away, I would refocus my energy on whatever I was doing in school, and at the end of the day, I looked back and I hadn't done any of the ticks at all. And then as soon as I had that revelation, for about 5 minutes, I would do nonstop ticks. And at this point, I didn't know back then, but at this point, it would be almost relatable to an orgasm. So that was defeating. I wound up in tears a lot of the time simply because I realized, oh man, I'm not getting rid of this thing. I'm just almost bottling it up. And then it gets even stronger and kicks me in the face at the end of the day. And it almost hurts, but at the same time, like, it feels really good to let go of it all. So I started thinking, maybe I just have to live with this Tourette's, and it's almost a, you know, I receive more pleasure than the average person, but I make a fool of myself during receiving it. So it was like, no, I can't live a life like that. Like, for this little bit of relief I get when I commit to the tick, to look like a fool in front of everybody I know, and that's who I am. I was like, no, absolutely not. So I said, there's got to be a breaking point. There's got to be a point where you blow that balloon up so big, it just bursts, it pops. So I continued week after week. It was probably, now let's say, I got to look back at medical records because I don't know exactly when I was admitted to the hospital for what's about to happen. But at some point, I was up there and it was getting close to sunset. The sun was actually almost down, so it was getting dark. And I needed to go home and I just said, I got to do this. And just kept focusing on my breath and seeming to like push this thing back further, deeper in my mind or behind me physically almost. And I felt a boom, like a big pop. I heard a pop. But there was, you know, I didn't feel any pain. It was not like I, you know, got accidentally shot by a hunter in the woods. It just, I felt it, I heard it, and something changed. I didn't know what, I couldn't explain it. I've never experienced that before, but I knew something changed. I felt a grasp, like I had won. Running up and down my spine, I had this feeling of I won. I did it. Well, a few days later, I had to get up for school. I believe it was a Monday morning, and I had a terrible, terrible headache. It felt like there was a vice grip inside my head, inside my brain, being opened from the inside outward. And I explained this to my mother. She didn't really seem to care. You know, I went to school. Actually, no, I remember this. Monday, I stayed home from school because of this. Tuesday, my mother made me go to school. I went to the nurse like almost immediately, and they kept trying to send me home. And my mother said no. So I stayed in school, miserable. I stayed in the nurse's office all day. Wednesday, she tried to force me to go to school again. I get into school, and it was just worse than ever. So they sent me home. I'm home, and writhing in pain, and my mother tells me I'm faking it, and she tells me to stop crying wolf. And another day goes by, and like I feel like I'm dying at this point. And she decides, I believe, to bring me to the hospital finally, or to the doctor, and he says, send them to the hospital right away, something's severely wrong. I get to the hospital, and I spent the next few days doing endless CAT scans, MRIs. I had spinal taps, I believe multiple spinal taps when I was an 11-year-old child, which, if you don't know the details of a spinal tap, they take roughly a foot-long needle that's about as thick as your pinky finger, and they stick it right into someone's spine, and they suck out spinal fluid to test it for meningitis and other deeper infections, which turned out to be pointless. So it was just medical torture that I suffered very young. And, you know, maybe every day 50 vials of blood were drawn from my arms. I looked like a ghost. There's photos of me. I was like drained of all my blood. I was dying. They didn't know what was going on. Finally, somebody noticed in a CAT scan there was something going on near my sphenoid sinuses, that there seemed to be a rupture in the sinus bone, and they didn't know how that would have happened. And all the doctors could deduce was that since I was born, over 11 years, there was an unformed part of my sinus, and over 11 years, the mucus from the sinus dripped onto my brain and caused an infection that finally hit me when I was 11. Now, as improbable as that sounds, you're right, it's improbable. It doesn't make any sense medically, scientifically, logically. It makes absolutely no sense. And it was them admitting that they did not have an answer for what happened. But I knew what had happened a few days before. And obviously, I wouldn't share something strange like that with anybody as an 11-year-old when my mother was already this kind of strange, like, indirect Munchausen's person, but opposite, like, there was never anything wrong, even when there was something wrong, and like, I don't know, like, wanted me to suffer, probably, now that I'm older, and I realize who she is, and who I am, is probably that she wanted me to suffer, because it wasn't the first time. So anyway, I wasn't going to share any extrasensory perceptions or intellectual derivations of reality structure that I had made as an 11-year-old, because I would have got called crazy or I was making things up, because even when serious things were happening, I was getting told I was making things up. So what I realized, and I am very sure of at this point because I've studied the brain in multiple anatomy, physiology, biomechanics classes, in my kinesiology studies in school. I've studied a lot independently since, because this is a subject matter very pertinent to my reality, and I think everybody's reality. But what had happened in that incident when I was on the mountaintop and I was breathing away and meditating away, or in a sense teaching myself meditation through trying to get rid of Tourette's, was I had created somehow almost an electromagnetic pulse from my pituitary gland and my pineal gland, which sit very close to each other and sit right near the sphenoid sinus bone. And that interaction between those two very, very powerful glands, and with the will that I was infusing into them, created some type of little like bomb in my brain, like an electromagnetic pulse, like an EMP in my brain, and was so powerful that it ruptured the bones of the sinus that sat directly beneath these two organs and created over a few days a mucus leak that gave, you know, started infecting my brain. So they discovered this. They went in through my nose. They did like an orthoscopic surgery up through my nose, nasal passage. And from what they described, which, you know, I'm 37 now, it's almost 30 years after, they did a wonderful job because I'm still alive and I haven't had headaches like that again. They said they did some type of procedure in which they scraped around the area and created scar tissue to close the little holes in the sphenoid sinus to replace the bone. So far, it's been effective. Those doctors, I believe, were by the names of Remsen and Taylor, and they were ears,
ear, nose, and throat specialists and surgeons, and I've heard amazing things about both of them, like them saving so many people's lives over the years. So those are really good doctors. So my three good doctors, Dr. Goyal, Dr. Remsen, and Dr. Taylor. Yeah, so quite an experience. So that moment where, you know, Tourette's was supposed to, that moment of life, those years, that era, and I still do experience the triggers from Tourette's, but nobody in my adult life, I don't think, would ever know or perceive that I had Tourette's without telling them, and I happily tell people when I feel, especially when I feel stressed and I do have a little bit of tics and I let them come out just because it is what it is. I'm not an 11-year-old, 13-year-old feeling like I'm judged by everybody. I realize every single person in this world has some type of flaws and they are very aware of their own flaws, so, you know, we don't need to judge other people. But as teenagers, we think that's the only reality there is. Anyway, this experience of kind of doing the impossible and a miracle happening for me, and this supernatural way of activating things in my body that we don't normally have access to consciously, allowed me an opportunity not just to conquer the Tourette's after that, because after that, anytime a trigger came on, I had this will to stop it. It's almost like you feel an itch and you don't scratch it and it goes away. And that's how Tourette's was after. Every once in a while, I scratch the itch. It is what it is. Like, it's a part of life, but I don't have to scratch the itch anymore, which is amazing. Now, if there's a way that science can figure out how to maybe, you know, trigger or stimulate the pineal gland and the pituitary gland, either through some type of chemical inducement or sound vibration or physical vibration or electromagnetic induction of some sort into people with Tourette syndrome and other neurological conditions that could create this phenomenon and replicate it. I mean, I don't think it's mad science to suggest that in a podcast. And if anybody might happen to hear this, that's in an area of expertise that might want to try something like that, you could change the world for the better forever. Figure out a way to vibrationally connect the pituitary and the pineal, and it can do miraculous things. So that's what I extracted from this. Now, fast forward 7 years, and I am in this car accident that I just spoke about in my last episode, but also, you know, there's videos on YouTube about it and lots of stories about it. I lost all ability through a severe traumatic brain injury to retain any new memories. So thank God, after I woke up from this accident and my brain swelling went down and I started to get back on my feet, I was still able to remember who I was and everything that had happened in the past, which in an accident like that, a lot of time people don't. They have permanent amnesia, they have, you know, retrograde amnesia, and it's a really challenging situation. I got very lucky somehow that my only affectation in my brain was storing new memories, which, yeah, admittedly sucked and was super tough going through college with that and trying to heal that and waiting for the brain to heal itself and forcing myself to try to learn, you know, practice memory games so that I could at least be on a normal level of memory proficiency like an average person. But right after the accident, I couldn't even remember my own name. If you asked me to write it on a piece of paper and turn it over, and a moment later you asked me what I wrote, I couldn't tell you. And that actually happened many times. That was a test a sports psychologist at the University of Rhode Island used to do with me to see how my memory was developing after all his work with me. And what I had learned after that was whatever process had happened during that Tourette syndrome resolution, pop in my brain, infection, almost dying and coming back to life thing, had given me an upper hand in this car accident in which part of my brain was no longer working, but I had a technique through the breathing and meditation and through almost muscle memory, or tissue memory, we should say, from what had happened 7 years earlier, that my brain had this, I don't know, will that was beyond my own will to repair itself, because it knew that it had done something amazing before and it healed me in a way that I had desired more than anything. And right now I was in that same place, maybe amplified times 10. I needed to heal, and I had no way, no knowledge, no experience, nobody helping me to find a way to really heal this thing and fix it and get it back to where it was and maybe better than where it was before. So my brain, my heart led me, but my brain did something miraculous that wasn't supposed to happen. Like, by all means, my memory was not supposed to come back, especially to the force it did, and to be photographic again. And beyond that, you know, the photographic memory I had prior to the accident was, I don't know how to say this, 3 times less. Like, the skill is amplified by 3 now, where my recall is ridiculous. Maybe because I did so many brain training exercises and memory exercises with this Dr. John Sullivan after, and it, you know, taught my brain new patterns that I didn't have before, because I relied on a photographic memory and I didn't have to do normal memory procedural stuff for learning like the average person does. I was now way below average, so my brain was taking these almost kindergarten through middle school lessons of how to structure itself to store memories properly. And then at some point, the photographic memory came back in. And the only way I can kind of reason it, provide some logic to it, is that when retraining my brain with John Sullivan and being in college, so force feeding my brain with tons of new knowledge, it got me back to like that 10% level that normal people operate. And then the photographic memory decided, okay, he's gotten himself back, we can come right back in, and the brain maybe healed itself physically at this around the same time. And everything came flooding in. I can remember anything that I was seeing, hearing, other people talking behind me. I'm in the library, and not only am I remembering what I'm reading, but I can also recall the things that I'm hearing at other tables and people talking in the background. And it became like a superpower very, very, very quickly. But there was still some misfirings. Like in anatomy class, a later professor found out that I was getting every answer right, but I was putting them one place wrong on the answer sheet. So there was something about when my brain was recalling these new memories, which it had just started to learn to do again, it wasn't necessarily spitting them out in the right order. And that was the next step of healing and structuring that I had to work on in my brain. And John Sullivan and the techniques he gave me, and just being in college and having to recall things where they're supposed to be, because otherwise I'd fail every test, was a nice refining edge for that coming back. But both of these things, and the point of this recording today, is to tell two true stories about the same person, very related stories, but very different stories, that prove that anything is possible. Literally anything is possible. None of that I've been through is any different than any struggle that you're going through, no matter what it is. And even if you're saying to yourself what you're experiencing or what you've gone through or what you're going through is way tougher and way different than what I went through, I understand. We all pity ourselves, but some people, I'm going to reference a friend I had when I was a kid who had severe, severe cerebral palsy and, you know, couldn't talk, was confined to a wheelchair his whole life, and he actually lived way longer than expected. They expected a few years, and I think he went to 18 or 19, Scotty. His name was Scotty. Eben, I'll say his full name, rest in peace, my friend. You were one of my best friends, and we never had a real conversation other than our eyes and energy, and it was so curious, and I wish I had spent more time with him. But what he had taught me was that, and Scotty was a very interesting guy. He couldn't express himself the way that we express ourselves, but I always got the feeling that Scotty was just super grateful, and he knew his situation, and he knew his difference in the situation from the rest of us, and he just felt super grateful. And I don't know, maybe the people around him, his mother and grandmother and siblings, might feel differently. I don't know, but I just feel like Scotty was super grateful, and that taught me that no matter what situation we have, it's all our perspective. And I'm not saying that Scotty could have willed himself out of that situation, especially with the medical world we experience now, which is based on limitation and money and, you know, just telling people what they can't do. And it just seems so silly and broken. But we go to them nonetheless for answers, and I feel like Scotty had all the answers. He just did the best he could with what he had. And I realized that I needed to do that. And I'm asking you that you can do that too. And also expect, know, believe fully in your heart that just because miracles happen to other people, they are also worthy of you and you are worthy of them. And when you start believing that, like, I never had a doubt in my mind that miracles were going to happen and I was going to fix these situations I was in. Never. And if a doubt ever came up, like, oh, it's not going to happen, that's where the breath comes in. You take that deep, long breath and hope for more, expect for more of yourself, of your potential, of your ability, of the universe. And let it channel a miracle through you, because they are possible. I didn't know I was creating miracles at the time. Now I know how to create miracles, and I want to share that. I'm sitting here laying on a couch in Costa Rica in my dream home at 37 years old with everything I could ever ask for except romantic love. But that is in the plans of the universe and life, and I trust in that. But as far as what I can manifest myself, I am standing on my 2 feet. I can go out and play basketball on my own basketball court right now. I can do a backflip into my own swimming pool. I can let my dogs run around freely without leashes. Like, these are dreams I've had my entire life, and they were able to manifest as miracles. Because we can will things into existence that might not have been possible for us or for anyone around us before, because no one believed in it enough. And I didn't realize that's what I was doing back on that mountaintop trying to get rid of Tourette syndrome. I was believing in something that was impossible. I was believing in myself. I was believing in a higher power so much that proof came. And I truly believe that's how this world works and this universe works, that, you know, when we have, I don't want to lecture on spiritual principles and stuff like this right now, but it's kind of when your heart's in the right place and you're doing something for the right reason, even if it seems like it's selfish. But if you're trying to heal yourself, that's not selfish. You're better for the world for healing yourself. So, you know, we like to complicate things because our egos get in the way. We judge ourselves. Other people judge us all the time. So we feel judged, or we're going to feel judged. Man, woman, whoever you are listening, miracles are possible. And they only happen to people that will them. Good people, bad people, I'm sure everybody experiences miracles, because it's just about, like, willing a thing into existence when you need it. It's not the secret, like that book, DVD thing. It's, Man, miracles can happen. I'm not speaking to people who want to make $1 billion right now. I'm speaking to people who want to heal from something, who want to get beyond a trauma psychologically, physically, to want something better for the reality. I'm speaking to those who are in a state of suffering, or maybe one day will be in a state of suffering, and you need to remember these words, that there is a miracle right there waiting in the universe, like it's a video game. You just need to grab it and bring it to yourself. And if you need a real, real miracle for the right reasons, maybe it's for somebody else, somebody in your life, you got to really believe it. And there's been times I should have believed in these miracles for other people that I cared about, and now they're dead. And I feel like I could have done more, and it's a small regret I have to live with. But luckily, I experienced a lot of abundant beauty with both of these people that I'm referencing. There's more, but there's two people that are in my mind right now that are very much my angels. They were my angels when they were alive, and they're my angels now. And my father was one of them, and I just wished, and I still wish more than anything, I could have somehow manifested a miracle to get rid of his cancer. But at the same time, I know him, I know his life, his legacy, and he lived 5 times more life and had beautiful experiences in his short life, which was still 63-64 years, than most people ever will in 10 lifetimes. So in terms of like doing life the right way, he did it. The other person who I dearly somehow wish I could do this in the next lifetime and be more aware, and if there's a way to like give my life for this person's life, I would do it, because she was an angel on earth. Her name was Caitlin Reese, and in some ways she was the love, we were each other's love of each other's lives, but we knew it wasn't this life. And we both knew that the moment we met each other, and we became these very close, honest, good friends. And she passed very, very young. I don't even think she was 30 years old, maybe 25 years old, of cancer. And I wish there was more I could have done for her in terms of, you know, you got to believe in these miracles, and I can get you proof, and there might be a technique to this. And I sound a little silly and ridiculous, but this is my podcast. I'm allowed to say what I want. And yeah, these hypotheticals, you know, are like regrets. And I know they seem ridiculous, like I can't will miracles for other people. But I do believe it's possible, because I have proof in my own life. And I believe fully that I'm recording this today because I wasn't able to say these words to my father as I spoke them today, and I wasn't able to say them to Katie. And maybe that would have made a difference for them. I don't know. I'll never know. I have to cycle back through the river of time again in other lifetimes to go through this, if I'm blessed with an opportunity to be in the cycle again. So for you, you have life. You have potential. You have people in your life that you can share this message with if you believe in it. Sometimes this life is meant to be temporary for some of us. Sometimes things can happen that can allow us to extend it. And when we do, we have to do good for other people with that borrowed time, with that gifted time. And I hope that I have done a bit of that in my borrowed time and time since my accident, and with some of the things I've learned, hopefully impacted some of you in a positive way. And maybe there is a lesson in here that science and medicine doesn't quite understand yet in 2022, but in the near future it will become a discernible awareness and understanding and mechanical system that they can break down and reverse engineer, so that, you know, people really can experience healing and miracles and the beauty of grace and redemption and second chances. and, you know, to be broken and to be put back together again. This world is really good at breaking us, and it hasn't really gotten great at putting us back together again. And I hope that future generations, if this message somehow transmits and survives the cataclysms that come, whether man-made or natural, that whoever hears this, whether now in 2022 or in the future, takes it as a seed of inspiration and possibility and potential and grows it into a tree that bears fruit for endless generations beyond us. So that's all I got today. A fun little story about two tragic things turned to very triumphant futures. So a little perspective, and I hope you enjoyed. Thank you for tuning in again, and if you really liked it, please share on your social media. I would appreciate it a lot. Thank you.